Hello, I'm Matt Matem, Deputy Editor of Total Film, and welcome to Inside Total Film, the weekly podcast from the Smarter Movie Magazine. Today, I'm joined by our news editor, Jordan Farley.
Hello.
And this week, we're chatting with Nia DaCosta about superhero latest The Marvels and reviewing that, plus thriller Anatomy of a Fall, Nicolas Cage surreal drama Dream Scenario, and Alzheimer's documentary The Eternal Memory. But before we get on to that, what have you been up to this week, Jordan? Have you seen anything, been anywhere exciting?
Haven't been anywhere exciting because I'm a shut-in, basically, and don't go anywhere. But I did watch something quite fun at the weekend, which was Quiz Lady,
which you
can currently see on Disney+/Star in the UK. If you don't know what it is, it stars Awkwafina and Sandra Oh as sisters. Awkwafina plays a character who is obsessed with this quiz show called Can't Stop the Quiz, which is hosted by a sort of Alex Trebek Jeopardy-style host played by Will Ferrell, which is very funny cameo. Through a series of kind of ludicrous machinations, her dog gets dognapped and she has to essentially go on this quiz show to win the money to be able to pay off the ransom for her dog. So it's just a very surreal, I thought, very, very funny comedy that I was actually pleasantly surprised by.
I'm glad you liked it because I actually saw that at TIFF, the Toronto International Film Festival, and I reviewed it and gave it 4 stars. Mm. And I always slightly worry, was I just in the festival sort of fever and just enjoyed seeing like a fun, mainstream, easy to watch film? But our reviews editor, Matthew Leland, he watched it recently and really liked it as well. So
yeah, I mean, humor is very subjective, but obviously, you know, we're 3 for 3 there. So I would say if you give it a shot, you're probably going to enjoy it.
And just Sandra Oh and Awkwafina just immensely good together there and sort of both kind of slightly playing against type in a way, which I liked. Mm-hmm. And I haven't been watching loads besides the stuff we're going to discuss this week, but I've been watching something and I'm only halfway through it because it's about 5 hours long in total, but it's RoboDoc, which you can probably ascertain from that portmanteau title, is a documentary about RoboCop. And so I hardly needed a sort of hard sell for this, given that RoboCop is one of my favourite films. But it has been pretty great so far. Loads of anecdotes, loads of talking heads, hearing from pretty much all the people you'd want to hear from, including Paul Verhoeven and Peter Weller, who doesn't seem to talk a lot about RoboCop that much anymore, and just like kind of what an intense guy he is. So I've been really enjoying that. Just lots of big personalities and fun stories. So I've been enjoying that a lot so far, but I'm only about halfway through the epic running time. It's kind of like a mini series in a way.
Yeah, I can't wait to check that out. RoboCop's having a little bit of a moment because there's a, I don't know if you are aware of this, there's a RoboCop video game that's just come out as well. Oh. So I don't know, some RoboCop's in the air, obviously.
Is it good? Is it supposed to be
it's
good?
It's meant to be all right. Yeah, okay. I think it's meant to be pretty decent. So yeah,
cool.
The RoboCop revival has started.
Your move, creep.
And so now let's dive into this week's new releases. And first, time to get 3 for the price of 1 with this.
Hi.
We're looking for Kamala Khan.
Tyrion! Okay, so our powers are entangled. I can manipulate light energy. And you,
I can totally show you.
Again.
Hi. Where's our daughter?
Wherever you were.
So this is The Marvels, the trinity of Captain Marvel, Monica Rambeau and Ms. Marvel. Before we get into reviewing the film, let's hear what director Nia DaCosta had to say about it when she sat down with Amy West earlier this week.
So I saw the first 20 minutes this morning, and as a superhero cat lover, I just want to thank you. But the movie jumps straight into the action. It kind of like throws us in with their powers being entangled. Was that something you really wanted to do from the get-go? And did you sort of worry about whether people had watched the series and could like keep up and stuff like that?
Yeah, I definitely wanted, because they're so disoriented with the switching, I wanted the audience to also be inside of their experience. I wanted it to be very subjective. And they each are doing 3 very different things when the switching starts. So I wanted that also to feel as jarring for the audience as it is for them. And then, yeah, they have like a whole history before this. We have like Ms. Marvel, the TV show, Captain Marvel 1, WandaVision. And it was kind of a constant negotiation and trial and error to figure out, okay, how much information do the people need? because we don't want people to have to watch anything else. But of course, it's like you also just have to be honest. Like, this is the 32nd project in this universe. It's sort of a sequel to 5 different things. So at a certain point as well, you're just like, okay, like there's some things that we can't get in here, but it'll be fun.
Yeah, and I wanted to ask you about, I love the juxtaposition of Kamala being so keen to see Captain Marvel and Monica really not wanting to talk to her right now. Can you talk a bit about Carol and Monica's like strained relationship and what that means for them both in the film?
The strained relationship really connects to what they're each struggling with individually. Monica's dealt with a lot of loss. Lost her mother, and then Carol, you know, went off and had to, you know, save the universe time and time again. And so she had to find her own way without her family. And then Carol is, I think, a bit avoidant and dealing with her trauma in her own way, but also does feel responsible for the safety of the entire universe. So we wanted to kind of look at that dynamic and show where they were, why, how they got there, and then kind of give a nice reconciliation for them.
And you have, that's kind of like the serious stuff, right? And then you have with Kamala. How fun was it to kind of explore your own sort of comic book nerd through Kamala in the film?
Oh, it's so fun. And also just with Amon, I'll be like, what are you reading? Like, send me, like, you know, she sent me like a Black Bolt like run that was really good. And I'm just like, yes. Like, so for me personally, it was very fun to work with Amon. And then in terms of her character, Kamala, it's just great to infuse that sort of enthusiasm for superheroes, for Marvel, from inside the film itself.
I was talking about grudges as well. I was surprised that Nick Fury wasn't a bit more salty with Goose.
Fury's just a very mature man. It's been 30 years. He's had time to come to terms and fall in love again with Goose, you know. She did what she did, but he's not an iconic-looking man because of it.
And I wanted to talk a bit about how Carol, you know, she's been doing this for almost 30 years now, and being a superhero and things like that. And then you have these two sort of fledgling superheroes. What does that mean for the film, and what can we expect when we see more of it?
I mean, what that means for Monica in particular, but also to a certain extent, Ms. Marvel, is that you get to see their powers grow and develop throughout the movie, which was really, really fun. So Monica uses her powers in certain ways for the first time ever in this film. And then you have Carol, who's like, you know, knows what she's doing, but has to learn how to work with these two women in particular, with the complication of the switching. So it was just a lot of fun to figure out how this would all work, but also see them become better at what they do.
So I read that you were a big comic book enthusiast. Was this something that you always kind of envisioned for yourself and wanted to do, or is it kind of something that's just happened sort of organically?
Both, actually. I always wanted to do a Marvel film. That's mostly the comics I read when I was younger, mostly Marvel comics like X-Men, Spider-Man. Also, it just kind of came about in a really natural way with this, like, Captain Marvel 2 happening, and then eventually them folding in these two other characters, and, you know, me doing the films I was doing in my own world, and knowing I wanted to kind of keep doing different things and not staying in one genre necessarily. And it all just kind of came together.
And you talked a bit about your past films. Did Candyman sort of specifically help you on this? Because it's kind of, I mean, I know people thought it was a reboot at first, and then it kind of sort of turned out to be a sequel, and this is obviously a sequel, but it's a big part of a bigger thing. How did Candyman help?
Yeah, it definitely helped because, you know, it was big brand, like not just MGM and, you know, but Jordan Peele is a brand in and of himself, and IP, Candyman, and IP that I loved a lot. I loved Candyman when I was younger, and I love horror. And, you know, servicing many, you know, one man, two governors, it's like that energy. It's like, you know, you have a lot of people you have to be making the movie towards, and this is like an even bigger, more exaggerated version of that. Even bigger brand, even bigger personalities, even bigger IP, even more fans. So it's a huge thing. As a director in that space, it was a bit of a, like, training wheels on Candyman to learn how to be a director instead of a studio system, and then coming into this system, which is very specific and its own world. And then on a practical, like, filmmaking point of view, you know, my first kind of extensive VFX were on Candyman. Nothing compared to this, but, you know, I didn't have a VFX supervisor on my first film. And then on Candyman, I had one. So I knew how to work with that department head. But on this one, like, the relationship is so much closer, so much deeper. But I had a bit of a jump start, I guess, from Candyman.
This is kind of a sidestep, but as a cat lover, I just wanted to ask about what it was like working with the cats on the set. Because, you know, they say don't work with animals. It can be difficult.
Put time in the schedule for it. Because if you think, you cannot be optimistic about the timing when you're scheduling for pets and animals. As a cat lover, you know, cats do what they want. We had amazing trainers, and the cats were really awesome. We also had kittens. kittens, and even the kittens were like hitting their marks. It was crazy. I mean, they mostly go from one place to another because there's food at the end, but you know, it's like, it was really cool to see how it worked, and it was really fun on days where we had kittens. Everyone's like holding one and walking around set, even though I'm allergic.
You and Brie love.
Yeah, yeah, she's really allergic. I'm allergic, but I was like, I'll just not be able to breathe. It's fine, but she's really allergic, so we had to like separate the two. But actually, no, we had a couple of days where she was there with the kittens, but yeah.
I wanted to talk to you about the action, because the switching obviously kind of forced you to be super creative with that, and I saw in the big fight at the beginning, it's so great, and I love Kamala's family. So I just wanted to ask, like, what was that like to come up with, and what was the biggest challenge of filming those sequences where they're switching all in and out?
It was really fun to come up with it, because you get to, one, I just love fight scenes in film, so to get to do one or several in this movie and then have this extra complication of the switching was really fun. And it weirdly sort of reminded me of like doing sequences in Candyman, where the complication was like the reflections and trying to get that right, and like, wait, so is that his right shoulder that we're seeing, or is he a reflection, or is he in the mirror, you know, like that kind of thing. And for this, it was like, okay, so she was there and now she's going to be there, and you know, you have to like, it's so specific. So for me, it starts at the script and making sure that's like all pretty clear, especially the scene that you saw with them switching from living room to the, you know, spaceship and all that stuff, and just like figuring it out from sort of, this is what I want to see, here are all the elements, here are all the steps, and just going like really methodically and like getting each thing. But it was really, really fun. Like, I cannot stress enough how much fun I had like building that and then editing it together. It was just great.
Did you have like the three actors on the sets, like as each person was kind of filming, to sort of like maybe be like, this is what I was doing?
Sometimes we had them all at once, or sometimes it would be, today we're doing Tiana's part, and then we'd do Brie, and then we do Iman. We have the stunties, of course, doing the things that we can't have actors do legally, or that they'd just be better at because they've trained for this their whole lives. And then sometimes we'd have like a digi double. It's like, oh, you know what? This actually needs to be even more extreme, so let's do digital. But yeah, it was a big mix of all of it.
You've obviously worked with Tiana before. What was it like reuniting with her on this and working with Brie and Iman as well?
Reuniting with Tiana was great. It was so funny because we went from like a genre film, but more grounded. It all takes place on this earth in a city that's real, you know, no one has superpowers. Oh, actually, debatable. And then to go to this, which is for both of us, like our first time making a huge film like this, was really exciting. It was good to have each other. And then Bree's done it before. So she was like, there was actually a really funny day. She and Tiana were in my office, and Bree's like laying on the couch, hands behind her head. And she was like, here's how it's going to go. Like, here's what's happening. Don't worry. Like, she was basically just like, we're all going to get through this. It's going to be great. But here are some tips for not, you know, breaking. Bend so you don't break, sort of thing. And then Iman was just the best. She was 18 when she started the shoot, 19 when we finished the principal photography. Just a really great human being, and so lovely, and so enthusiastic, and so professional, like knew the lines, like hit her marks, like she was amazing. So it was really great.
And I wanted to talk to you about Samuel Jackson's chemistry with Brie Larson as well, and how that's kind of influenced Nick Fury and Carol Danvers' friendship on screen. What are they like together on set?
So they're like best friends. Like, Brie Larson and Samuel Jackson are basically best friends. I love them together. It's such a sweet dynamic. And I think it mirrors what Nick Fury is to the MCU, which is like, he's kind of like everyone's dad. And he's sort of like, you know, why are the kids fighting? What's happening? Like, how can I help? Like, who do I need to get here to do their chores? You know, like, he very much is that in this movie for Brie, or for Carol. And also for Monica as well, because Monica in the film, when we meet her, she's working for Fury. So, and then, of course, Iman's like, can you be my dad, please?
Can you talk a bit about what we can expect from Nick Fury in this as well? Because I'm guessing this comes after Secret Invasion, and he kind of went through it in that series. Yeah. And we kind of get a different taste of him again in this. Yeah. From what I've seen so far, kind of a lighter Nick Fury.
100%, yeah. You know, he's very weary after the events of Secret Invasion. It's a lot. And as we've seen him throughout the MCU, he's sort of obsessed with, like, protecting the entire world. It's like, how can I do that? How can I... Like, in Winter Soldier, you see him, like, doing some ill-advised things, trying to, like, be on top of everything. And now he's in space, literally watching the entire planet. So I think it's just a continuation of that. And then in terms of tone... You know, we wanted to kind of have a connection to Captain Marvel, where we see a lighter side of him because of his relationship with Captain Marvel. And what I like about Fury is, like, he kind of shifts depending on who he's with. And I think with these three women, he's very much the lighter, softer side of Fury.
And I have to ask about this. Kind of much has been made online about Darben looking to have a similar bangle to Kamala Khan, and also carrying the Warhammer. Mm-hmm. It seems like she's kind of collecting things from different things. Because obviously in Ms. Marvel, we saw that the bangle was on a Kree.
And also, if you read the comics, there isn't just one Warhammer or one Cosmorod in our movie. It's a universal weapon. I kind of go by comic terminology a lot because I'm just really connected to that part of the world. So definitely, I think in our movie, it like reveals her status in the Cree world, having that. And then with the bangle, yeah, there's a lot to her attaining that. That's really pertinent to the film.
Were there any sort of specific comic book issues that you looked at to help you with your inspiration?
Yes, there were a few. The first issue where we meet Monica Rambeau, which is in a Spider-Man issue, and he's like basically being such a creep. He's like, there's someone in this airport who's giving me vibes. And he like sees her and he's like, I'm going to follow her. And the text is, who's that lady? Which I love. For Captain Marvel, Kelly Sue DeConnick just had like a brilliant run on that. And there's a moment where in one of the issues she's falling. Because she's basically a dry drunk. Basically, she's like an alcoholic in recovery. And she's falling to Earth. And it's like the only way she can get a rush is if she does that, because she cannot die. Nothing can harm her. And I was like, oh, I really like that conceptually, like this, the inner life of her. So like a lot of that work came into this in building out more of Carol's character. And then just the first, like, I'd say six issues of Ms. Marvel are just perfect. So we pulled from that too.
Right. So at the time of this initial recording, we haven't actually seen the Marvels yet, Jordan, have we? So
nope.
We're going to need to now drop in a recording from our future selves to review the film. So here that is.
We're a team.
Oh, no, we're not a team.
We're not a team.
Jordan, for anyone who's not aware of what the Marvels is or how it fits into the Marvel Cinematic Universe, could you set us up, please?
I mean, that's a very big question, Matt. How does this fit into the Marvel Cinematic Universe? Yeah, so this is a sequel to 2019's Captain Marvel, directed by Candyman's Nia DaCosta, as you said. Brie Larson returns as Carol Danvers, aka the actual Strongest Avenger. This film opens with a new villain, Dar Ben, played by Zoe Ashton. She's a sort of Kree leader, and she's exhuming some kind of artifact on a distant planet, which turns out to be a very familiar looking bracelet if you've seen Ms. Marvel, the MCU TV show starring Iman Vellani, because that is the other bracelet that she has the twin bracelet to. So immediately there's some kind of connection to that character. Meanwhile, in a different part of the universe, Theona Paris's Monica Rambeau, who, of course, everyone will know from WandaVision, is doing some kind of spacewalk on the Saber Station, which is currently being led by a post-Secret Invasion Nick Fury. Obviously, a lot of ties into TV shows, so if you haven't been keeping up with your Marvel shows, you might be a little bit lost at this point. But she's doing a spacewalk, and there's some kind of tear in the sort of jump gate technology, which is sort of used in various films, but mainly Guardians of the Galaxy. So there's some kind of tear in that. And for inexplicable reasons, both Monica and Carol decide to sort of touch these tears at a sort of similar moment in time. And this causes some kind of body swap element or kind of anomaly, where whenever these three characters, Ms. Marvel, Photon, aka Monica Rambeau, and Captain Marvel use their powers, they kind of switch places instantaneously across time, across space, which is actually the basis of quite a fun sort of opening set piece, where these characters are taking on these various Kree characters, and suddenly people are swapping in and out. Carol suddenly appearing in Ms. Marvel's childhood bedroom and walking down and meeting all her family in her house. So it's all a little bit hectic at the start. So the opening kind of salvo of this film is working out what the hell is going on between these three characters who were body swapping seemingly at random moments. Eventually that's all sort of resolved. They all kind of get together, they work out what's going on, and they realize that they have to stop Dar Ben before she can succeed in her plan to restore her home planet of Hala, which is suffering as a result of actions taken by Captain Marvel in the interim between that first film and the second film. And probably won't say too much more about the plot than that, because it's sort of something you probably want to discover in the moment, but that's sort of the basis. And after that, the Marvels, as Iman Vellani's Ms. Marvel kind of dubs them, they go out on their sort of adventures across the universe trying to stop Dar Ben before this potential universe-ending consequences can be enacted. So that's sort of the basic setup.
Yeah. So that's what to expect from the film. But Did you actually like it?
Yeah, overall, I would say yes. With some quite extreme caveats, I would say. I did find it really fun. In particular, I found Iman Vellani to such good value. Yeah. For me, she was the absolute standout of this film. Really, really funny. She adds a totally different flavor to the film because Carol and Monica are, in a way, quite severe characters. And there's a very tense sort of history to these characters because, of course, Carol knew Monica when she was a young girl, knew her mother, Maria Rambeau, and has essentially abandoned them in 30 years since then. And Monica is very upset and unhappy about this. So that is kind of hanging over the film for much of the first half, at least. Mm. And Iman Vellani comes in as Miss Marvel, and she's just this total breath of fresh air. She's an absolute fangirl for Captain Marvel, for Carol Danvers, daydreams about wanting to be Carol Danvers' twinsies, as she says, because of course she's Ms. Marvel and they have a very similar name. So she just brings a sort of more esoteric and irreverent kind of flavor to the proceedings. So I really, really enjoyed that element. There are some very inventive set pieces. I wouldn't want to spoil too much, but there's a terrific one involving the Flerkins,
yes,
which is very much a highlight of the film for me. As with a lot of Marvel films, I think this falls down massively on its villain, who is just a little bit, a little bit one note, feels a little bit like a Ronan the Accuser, like rerun, like, because it's another Kree. Mm. She has like the same universal weapon that Ronan the Accuser had as well. Almost feels like, oh no, we're doing this again. She has a little bit more of a sympathetic motivation, I would say, which sort of ties into some backstory with Captain Marvel, which I thought was done quite well. But apart from that, I would have just liked to know just a bit more personality with Darben especially, and the people surrounding her as well. Like, she sort of has a second in command who's clearly just there to be a character for her to talk to and nothing else. Like, he just has no discernible personality beyond that, and then also sort of disappears at one point in the film, which I found quite weird. Like, I thought that there were some things like that where I just thought it was very noticeable that it was a slight victim of like reshoot-itis, where there were clearly things that were supposed to happen and didn't, and things had been changed and moved around. But ultimately, I do think it actually works. Obviously, the buzz going into this film has been about as bad as the buzz for a Marvel movie has ever been. Like, the box office projections are like awful for what a Marvel movie should have been. There's a lot of sort of bad faith decrying of what this film is because it's, it's female-led. It's a first female black director to make an MCU movie. And obviously, I don't ascribe to any of those criticisms of the film, but it's coming at a really bad time for Marvel as well, because I think the whole MCU experiment is kind of at a low ebb. Like, interest in it seems to be at its lowest point since it started over a decade ago. And creatively, I don't think they've been hitting the high watermarks that they did, particularly in the Infinity Saga era. So it's coming at a really difficult time, and I think a lot of people have been almost willing this to fail in a way, just to sort of teach Marvel a lesson. And actually, I think it's A, unfair to put that on the shoulders of this film, and B, actually not accurate, because this is actually quite fun and actually better than a lot of recent films, I would say. I still don't think it's up to the level of, those first few phases, especially in the run-up to Infinity War and Endgame, but I would say you'd probably have a pretty good time going to see this on a Friday night.
Yeah, it's sort of boring to sort of come in and say this, but I do pretty much agree with everything you've said. And like, we obviously saw this together, really, really enjoyed Iman Vellani as Kamala Khan in the Ms. Marvel series. And yeah, to me, she was the kind of standout here. Really enjoyed her and love her sort of family as well, her parents and her brother. And like, they have the most fun and funny moments.
They get to interact with Nick Fury a lot. Which I think they're like an odd pairing, but they're really good value together.
And so I enjoyed that. And I know it was, to me, it was one of those films that it was just plenty of fun while it was on. I also like Tiona Paris a lot as well. I didn't mind Zora Ashton as Darben the villain, but I kind of agree that I thought it was just, she was fine, like performance wise and everything like that. But like you say, it just felt a bit like we'd seen her before, was a bit one note, like, because it was, because she's a Kree, it just felt like we were kind of, going back over past territory we've already seen. And to me, she was fine, but just not at all standout or memorable, and just won't be remembered as the worst ever MCU villain, but just also won't ever really be remember this as one of the better ones either, just probably a villain that we're likely to forget about. And I thought, I liked the fact there were some fun, silly moments. And I was, you know, it's fairly nippy in its runtime. And so I sort of was entertained throughout. I did think there were some weak visual effects in it. What I found, and again, in a way we can't really go into now, but discussing with you after the film, when we just emerged from the cinema, I found that, like, I enjoyed it, but there was just kind of so many sort of plot holes and things that I was left thinking about afterwards, where I sort of enjoyed it at the moment, but I found it didn't really stand up to a great deal of scrutiny afterwards. Mm-hmm. That, like, I enjoyed the personalities, you know, the fun, the jokes. But then when I actually thought about it, I was just like, oh yeah, this aspect doesn't really make sense. And like, why did this happen? And what was going on with that power there, you know, and things like that. Yeah. So yeah, I felt like it didn't really hold up to scrutiny a great deal.
It's definitely not watertight. I mean, there's very few Marvel films probably you could say are watertight, but this one in particular felt like, yeah, it was a very leaky ship, I think, in that sense. In terms of the visuals, I actually thought this was actually one of the sort of nicer looking Marvel films in a little while, especially compared to something like Quantumania, which had very, very ropey visual effects. I thought there were just some really nice sort of planetary vistas, and they go to some quite cool looking locations. And, you know, there are some slightly ropey digi doubles and things like that, like the things that are notoriously tricky to get right in the visual effects realm. But actually, in terms of sort of the visual design of it, I actually was quite awed by it at points, especially because we saw it at IMAX. And there are like shots that are in full frame IMAX for this. And I was like, wow, some of that does look actually quite cool.
Yeah, I agree that some of the vistas were good. It was mostly sort of character and power based for me that I had the issues with. And something which I just always have a slight issue with, although I fully get this, and I did enjoy the Flurkins a lot. And obviously there's some very, very cute Flur kittens in it. But my eyes are never sort of kind on CG animals. And I felt like they leaned too much on the CG for the animals. I would just like to have seen a few more real life kittens in there blended in with the VFX. But I felt like I was barely looking at a real cat at any of the moments in this. I know from the interview they did have cats on set, and obviously Brie Larson and Nia DaCosta are allergic, but so maybe that minimized the use. But I know they did have cats there, so it just was a shame to not see a few more on the screen. And I sort of think you get that better result when you blend the real with the VFX in those kind of cases when it comes to animals and things. But there you go, that's just a personal grumble of mine.
And there's always that tricky thing, because flying characters are still just like very, very difficult to make look sort of cool and convincing on screen. And obviously big part of Carol's power set is that she can sort of zip around anywhere she wants to. So you just get a lot of moments where it's like a lot of face acting, like while she's flying, and you're like, oh, this isn't entirely holding together, but I appreciate them for going for it. What did you think of Brie in this one then? Because she is obviously Captain Marvel was like a huge hit, and there must be like big fans of this character out there, but I feel like she's sort of one of the least loved Marvel characters, a little bit unfairly. I don't really know. I did actually like her in this performance. She gets to let loose a little bit at points. There's a sort of excursion to a sort of musical planet, we'll say, where she gets to do something very different with this character, which I thought was a lot of fun, and actually lent into her more like natural charms, as opposed to the quite stoic way that she has to behave most of the time. But how did you feel about her in this?
I do like Brie Larson a lot as an actor. I didn't think this was her sort of strongest performance, but I agree that I liked that she was a bit more fun. The musical planet, I wish they'd have leaned into it a bit more, and it was a shame they didn't have a stronger sort of set of songs there. But I thought that was a fun idea, and I really appreciated them just doing something really fun and silly there. So I thought that was a nice moment. And I thought Brie was fine, but I actually thought, I mean, considering this is effectively a Captain Marvel sequel, I actually thought the other two stood out a bit more, to be honest. So, I mean, fair play to her for sort of, you know, not just relegating them to sidekicks, but I sort of warmed to those characters more. Maybe there was just a bit more going on with those characters, maybe. But that said, I actually enjoyed them all as a trio as well. And if anything, it's like, I know we often don't say this, but I could have even done with the film being slightly longer, because it was about 105 minutes, is it? Yeah, so hour and three quarters, which is a nice, you know, nice lean sort of runtime. I'm not saying it needs to be massively longer, but I just enjoyed it when they were hanging out together, the three of them. So I would have just almost liked just a tiny bit more of that, really, to be honest. Again, I thought she was fine, if not my favourite performance of hers, and yeah, not my favourite performance of the film.
I would agree with that. The thing I struggled with a little bit was, obviously, Captain Marvel is the strongest Avenger by an absolute mile, and she's generally considered, invincible, unstoppable. And in this, it just felt like, her powers, she just didn't seem as powerful in this film for some reason. I didn't really entirely understand what Darben's powers were and why she was able to just like take punches from Captain Marvel just very easily and just bounce back. Like, so it didn't make any sense to me why Captain Marvel wasn't just absolutely dominating every situation she was in, given that, she was able to overpower Thanos like with an Infinity Gauntlet. Like, I feel like, the power levels are just a bit confusing to me at this point.
Me too. And that's something I must admit, I struggle with that with these films, where it's just like what I was sort of touched on earlier with the sort of plot holes that ties into it for me, where if you just give the powers any sort of thought, if you don't just go with the flow, then you just think, why wouldn't you just do X, Y, and Z? You'd never end up having like a normal fist fight if you actually just had these powers. So yeah, so again, I find that fun in the moment, but if I give it too much thought, then I just start getting annoyed about the powers, to be honest.
Yeah, as is the way. We should also say, but not spoil, that there is a very, very exciting mid-credits scene for this film that you absolutely should stay and watch.
Yes.
We won't go into any more details, but it is... So it's a rare recent one where you think, they will definitely kind of follow up on this one. This isn't going to be a Harry Styles situation where we're probably never going to see the people who appear in this post-credit scene again.
Yeah, and there's kind of there's kind of a scene right at the end of the film that feels like a post-credit scene, but is actually on the end of the film. And then you get like this mid-credits, which both of them are quite exciting. But then you don't get a true very end of the credits scene here.
Yeah, you get a sound effect. That's it. So depends how completist you are. If you want to hang around, I wouldn't say it's essential to stay right to the end of the credits, unless you want to respect all the crew people and watch their names scroll by.
So that is The Marvels. And broadly speaking, I mean, you can hear we both kind of enjoyed it with reservations. So yeah. If you fancy seeing that, and if you are an MCU completist, that is out in cinemas on Friday. And next, what's your step now with this?
So, as you know, the autopsy report is inconclusive about the cause of death.
Stop. I did not kill him.
That's not the point.
Il parle de tromperie.
I was honest about it.
Mais vous l'avez pas été l'année de sa mort avec cette fille avec qui vous l'avez trompé, pourquoi? Il y a quand même quelque chose d'un peu étrange dans cette situation. Vous admettez qu'il était jaloux?
Non, I don't know. No.
Allez, écoutez-vous, on a l'impression que vous l'avez trompé continuellement.
Quand il commence à se reprocher des trucs, moi je préfère m'en aller.
Tu peux pas me dire qui était le plus énervé des deux?
Non.
So that was Anatomy of a Fall, and if you sort of follow news out of film festivals, you'd have probably heard about this film. I've only just now seen it for the first time in time for this podcast. But Jordan, for anyone who hasn't heard of it, could you set it up for us, please?
Yeah, so this is writer-director Justin Trier's Palme d'Or-winning courtroom drama. It stars Sandra Hüller, also as Sandra, a writer of some renown who lives in an isolated chalet on a snowy mountain in Grenoble with her husband Samuel, her young son Daniel, who was blinded in an accident years earlier, and their adorable border collie, who we will be speaking a lot more about later. The film sort of opens with Sandra being interviewed by a young woman. During the interview, music starts blasting from upstairs. Bizarrely, the steel drum introduction to 50 Cent's PIMP, which I was not expecting to happen in a Palme d'Or winning film. But when this happens, you sort of immediately assume that this is some kind of passive aggressive act by her husband, who is unseen in the frame, but you know that he's kind of lurking upstairs somewhere. So Sandra sort of abruptly ends this interview and sends the young woman home. Shortly after, Daniel takes his dog Snoop out for a walk, and when they return, Samuel is lying dead on the floor outside their home. Did he jump? Was he pushed?
no one can truly know because Sandra was the only person at home and the only witness who wasn't even present at the time is blind. So then around a year later, Sandra is put on trial over Samuel's death. But because there's no evidence, there's no sort of physical evidence whatsoever, and no witnesses to the actual event, it's really a trial about Sandra's sincerity and her believability, and sort of their relationship is what is put into focus. Was there potentially motive for Sandra to kill Daniel? That sort of becomes the big question rather than what is the evidence that she did or did not do this? And then, you know, in classic sort of courtroom movie fashion, there's compelling testimony from experts, there's smoking gun evidence that isn't what it first appears to be, antagonistic prosecutors and defenders, all this kind of classic stuff. But I mean, one of the big things that separates this from, you know, your Primal Fears or your To Kill a Mockingbird is the fact that this is obviously set in a French court rather than an American court, which operates very differently from the American justice system. They don't sort of spell it out what the differences are, but there's something sort of much more informal and calm about French court. It's a lot more intimate. So the jury sits up with the judges and you have like the prosecutors and the defenders just kind of walking around. Mm. And there seems to be a rule that no one can raise their voice. So there's no kind of big operatic grandstanding like you get in classic courtroom dramas. And seemingly anyone can sort of interject and speak whenever they want. So I found it super interesting in the fact that there's just very different rhythms to this as a courtroom movie compared to what you're really used to. And then you have the fact that, you know, the film is sort of jumping back and forth between the court and Sandra and Daniel's home, where Sandra is under house arrest because obviously Daniel is a minor and she sort of still has to look after him, even though she's potentially on trial. It could potentially be going to jail for her husband's murder anytime soon. There's an awful lot going on in this film. I like the fact that Sandra is a multilingual character. Mm. She is German, but has a French husband. She is fluent in French, but she's also fluent in English and seems to prefer speaking in English. And there's a question about when and why she's using different languages. Sometimes she'll use French, sometimes she'll switch to English because it's a language she is potentially better at lying in, you might think. There's all these sort of things going on. The fact that Sandra is a writer also becomes a concern. She writes fiction novels that are very closely based on her own life experiences. And there is a novel which is brought to light in which a character talks about wanting to kill their husband. Is that an issue? Is this an admission of guilt within her own fiction? So there's tons and tons of depth, tons and tons of stuff going on in this film. And I thought it was pretty gripping for the most part. What did you think?
Yeah, I agree. I think you've obviously summed it up really well there, but it's a fairly long film. It was about 2.5 hours, I think.
That's right, yeah.
It's really focused on just this one incident. And obviously you do learn more about their lives and, you know, you get some flashbacks and things like that. And there's just more layers like peeled back as you go along. Yeah, I did find it really, really gripping, and the courtroom setup and the fact, a bit like the kind of the best murder mysteries, if you want to call it that, it is a really compelling setup because there's just so many kind of interesting elements to it, from the chalet where it's set to the son who, you know, has kind of visually impaired, these various motives. It was just a really intriguing setup. And the kind of, even when they're first looking at the dimensions of the window and stuff that you fell out of, and thinking, oh, what would it take for someone to fall or be pushed out of there, and where the blood might splatter depending on where he landed and what he hit on the way down. So it was just really interesting. I was really, really sort of gripped the whole time. Sandra Hüller's one of those people she's just literally just amazing to watch. I kind of just feels that she's really one of those actors just at the very top of their game. She's also amazing in The Zone of Interest coming up in a few months. And you might know her from Tony Erdman as well, so like a few years back. She's very good in that. So just literally just watching it for her, I feel that you could just watch it for her alone. And I'm always a sucker for sort of ambiguity as well. And it really, really sort of treads that line the whole time, really, where you're just not sure who to believe, not sure which side to go on, not sure what's the right decision, realizing that whichever decision you make could be terribly wrong in some way. You mentioned obviously the son as well, the son whose sight was damaged, but apologies for probably mangling his name, but he's played by Milo Mercado Greiner, how I would pronounce it. And I thought he was really great. I thought that was a really great sort of child performance. And it's not a particularly showy film in a lot of ways, as you mentioned, partly because of the nature of their courtrooms. And so it's not kind of really flashily directed, but there was a few really nice moments, I thought, like some interesting zooms. And there was this great moment where the kid Daniel is sort of in the dock and the camera is kind of like swaying from side to side with the different people speaking. Mm-hmm. And I thought that was just a really nice touch, basically. So I just thought this was just a really, really enjoyable sort of adult drama, really.
Completely agree with all of that. Daniel ultimately becomes like a super important figure in the trial, doesn't he? Because obviously he's blind. He doesn't know what's happened. So it essentially comes down to he sort of has to pick a side, essentially. Like, it's either does he choose to, you know, back his mother, who is alive and potentially will be in his life for as long as he lives, or does he have to, you know, publicly declare that his father has committed suicide when he doesn't know that for sure and what the implications of that would be on him and on his relationships with other people going forward. Like, it's very knotty. It's very compelling kind of stuff. Yeah, there's just a lot going on, which, you know, you would expect for a 2.5-hour film, I guess. One that isn't full of plot, if you know what I mean, in that sense. But both you and I have both seen The Zone of Interest. This year at Cannes was a particularly hard-fought year, I think. There were a lot of great films at the festival this year, and the fact that this did emerge sort of triumphant, I think, speaks to the quality of it. I think if you're going in expecting a classical sort of courtroom drama with big, grand moments of tearful resolution, that's sort of not what this film is. It's a bit more muted. It's a bit more laid back in a way, even though it is, you know, it is a murder trial. It can get very intense at points. It just has a different feel and different rhythms, and I really like that about it. It just wasn't what I was expecting going in, and so by the end, I thought, oh, that is actually something a little bit different, something I haven't really seen before. And we should also speak about the dog, previously teased, played by a dog called Messi. A border collie who gives basically the most unreal, like unbelievably good dog performance I think I've ever seen, because there's this moment where he has to like act sick, basically, and I don't know how on earth that trainer got the dog to act like that.
Yeah, it's slightly worrying almost. So such good acting.
Yeah, I was like, is that dog actually okay? And then it sort of pops up and you're like, oh yeah, it's fine, yeah, great. What a performance. Yeah. That dog actually won the Palme d'Or as well.
Did it? Oh,
The revered award that's also handed out at Cannes.
Rightfully so.
Exactly.
I mean, we're basically both saying, yes, this is highly recommended. Mm-hmm. And so if you do want to catch that, that's Anatomy of a Fall, and it's in cinemas from Friday too. So time to move on to the stuff of dreams now with this.
Have you been dreaming about me?
Have I been dreaming about you?
Yeah. There's like 100 messages. Somebody wants to interview me.
Well, this is strange. Maybe you should take a minute and think before you do anything drastic.
Why me? I don't know. I'm special, I guess.
How does it feel to go viral?
Who's actually had a dream about me?
That was Dream Scenario, and we're really into festival territory this week. Just seems to be all the films that kind of played at festivals earlier this year are now coming out.
Yep.
But I didn't actually see this film at TIFF. I couldn't make the schedule work, but I was hearing really good buzz about it. So Jordan, again, for anyone who hasn't heard of this yet, what is the premise here?
Yeah, so this is the English language debut of Norwegian director Christopher Borgli, who made a very well-regarded film called Sick of Myself in 2022. And I have to say, he's a very rare filmmaker who knows exactly how to use Nick Cage. Cage stars as Paul Matthews, an evolutionary biology professor. He's a very unremarkable man in most respects, very insecure. He's desperate for his writing to be published and has a lot of professional jealousy of colleagues who have achieved sort of levels of success that he hasn't. At one point, it sort of comes to light that people have started dreaming about Paul, though. It starts off with his daughter and then people in his classroom and then complete strangers. And then he's getting hundreds, thousands of messages from random people telling him about the fact that he is appearing in their dreams in quite a benign fashion, because he appears in their dreams as, you know, the craziest thing could be happening. And then he'll just appear and walk through as like just some wayward observer, essentially. Like, he doesn't interact with the dreams at all. He might say something, but he barely seems to acknowledge the other people's presence. He'll just look across, smile, and that'll be pretty much it. So This, obviously, this crazy phenomenon results in Paul becoming something of an overnight celebrity. He's sort of interviewed on television programs. He becomes a sort of viral hit. In the classroom, he's sort of mobbed by people who want pictures and selfies with him. And this is something that he's very keen to capitalize on, to, you know, both fuel his ego and hopefully get his book, which is about ants, published. But as Paul's own dream sort of failed to materialize, his sort of book deal doesn't happen as he sort of wants it to. He comes across the fact that certain people are having dreams that aren't just to do with him standing there. They start to get a bit weird. They start to turn a bit nightmarish. And as that happens, it starts to become an epidemic, essentially. People start having nightmares where Paul features and where Paul turns into something of a kind of Freddy Krueger figure who is like murdering people in their sleep. But, you know, they're waking up the next morning. They're not actually being killed in their dreams. So after this, Paul himself becomes a bit of a pariah. I don't want to go much further than that, but it's sort of about how this sort of situation almost spirals out of control, and certainly out of Paul's control, given the fact that he doesn't have any say in what people are dreaming about. He's just a man who happens to be popping up in people's, you know, unconscious thoughts. And I really, really enjoyed this. I thought this was terrific. A really pleasant surprise. You know, you get all these dreams that play out. They have that, you know, you get sequences with dream logic and kind of nightmare imagery. But the sort of real world here is almost as absurd as the stuff you get in the dreams, which is the thing I really liked. And Cage's performance is just strikes that exact right tone for that type of film, where he's sort of playing it straight, but he also does it in that extreme sort of cagey way where I just found him like really, really funny. Like, his body language in this is great. He pulls some like unbelievably funny faces at points. He just is the perfect match for this material, I think, which often isn't the case with him. But I think he's found kind of a kindred spirit in Christopher Borgli. He's just a wonderful character as well. Paul is just like this complete failure of a man, essentially. And you do feel a bit of sympathy for him, but he also just makes things worse for himself repeatedly, to the extent that you're like, oh man, like, you could just get out of this quite easily if you weren't such a fool all of the time. And there's some really great side characters in this as well. Michael Cera pops up as a kind of PR person who is potentially going to work with Paul. And all he's interested in is getting Paul to kind of promote brands, essentially. At one point, he suggests that Paul could like pop up in people's dreams, like showing them a Sprite or something. But all he wants to do is get these people to help him write his book about ants. So it's like he has all these conflicting voices who are trying to get him to do things, while he's dealing with this just unprecedented scenario where he's one of the most famous people in the world for doing absolutely nothing. It's an idea that I wasn't sure could be sustained over a feature film, because it's, you know, it sounds great on paper, but it's like, where is that going to go? But I actually found that the sort of escalation and the way that the perception of Paul changes as the dreams change, I actually found that to just be really compelling, like almost to the end.
I had like almost the exact same thought, where I loved the sound of the idea, and I loved it sort of as it started, and it's sort of, as you mentioned, obviously Cage's performance, and it's in that, I love it when he is in that weird sort of off-kilter surreal drama kind of mode. And it's quite Charlie Kaufman-esque in a way, I thought, and I absolutely love Adaptation, which was obviously written by Charlie Kaufman. And features possibly my favorite Nick Cage performances.
Whoa, big words.
I should say, yeah. But so I love the idea of this. But then, even as I was enjoying the beginning, I was thinking, oh, can this sustain a whole film? Is this idea just going to sort of peter out a bit? But I really thought it sort of satisfied until the end, basically. I really, really thought it worked. I really liked where they went with it. I liked the kind of things they dug into with it. It was very funny. I sort of laughed out loud several times, but it was also quite poignant in places as well. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was just so awkward just following him around the whole time. Whatever scenario he was in, he was just able to kind of mess it up, and sort of through his own fault, and not, he's just put into these really awkward scenarios where he's just such a sort of clumsy interloper, you know, to quote Succession briefly. But I just really enjoyed it the whole way. And yeah, there's some really interesting side characters there. Julianne Nicholson's very good as his
she's great.
Wife. She's always someone who I enjoy when she pops up. And yeah, Michael Cera, very funny, as you explain. And it's just sort of, it's interesting on a lot of things, like on fame, on going viral, on sort of seizing your moment, all that kind of stuff. Also, it was produced by Ari Aster as well. And we both, because me and Jordan saw this together, and we sort of said, there's definitely like Bo is Afraid parallels to this, if you like that.
Yeah, definitely.
And so you can see why it kind of would have appealed to Ari Aster to get behind it and sort of throw his support behind it. But it was right up my street. I'll sort of say that. I just really, really enjoyed it.
We said earlier, like, humor is often completely subjective, but I was really laughing a lot during this. This is another comparison point to Bo is Afraid, but this has like a sort of sex scene, which has one of the funniest sort of resolutions that I've seen since Bo is Afraid. Like that and Bo is Afraid's sex scene are sort of neck and neck for the two funniest sex scenes of the year, I think. And they're both great in that, you know, Cage and Joaquin Phoenix, in the case of Bo, are just perfectly happy to send themselves up by just humiliating themselves on screen during sex scenes. But yeah, I thought that was great. The one misstep I thought this made was it kind of does something towards the end where it introduces almost like a sort of pseudo-scientific element to what's going on. And I thought that was almost like, and it's in the name of satire, essentially. It's sort of hard to explain without spoiling it. But I thought that was just a sort of satirical step too far, I thought. I would have preferred if what exactly was going on just remained a complete mystery. I sort of didn't like the idea that it could, there is the insinuation that it could be harnessed by science in a sort of Charlie Kaufman, Eternal Sunshine kind of way, where you can sort of survey people's thoughts and dreams and stuff. I could have done without that, but apart from that, I thought this was very solid. I certainly wouldn't let that put you off, because this is very much worth checking out. There are moments where you think what you're watching is part of reality, and then all of a sudden something absolutely wacky will happen and you're like, oh, okay, we're in a dream again. And then when the dreams start do turning into nightmares, it does get like quite graphically violent, and it gets like quite scary and quite intense at points. I was surprised how far it went in that sense. It really does commit to the nightmare side of things.
Yeah, so be prepared for that, because I sort of saw a poster that just has a quote saying like, pure comedy gold, like Nicolas Cage has never been funnier. And whilst like aspects of that are true, it is very funny. Just be warned that it isn't just a straightforward like laugh a minute comedy. There are some kind of dark and scary elements to it as well.
Yeah,
but again, this one is another one this week that comes highly recommended from both of us, I'd say.
Yeah, absolutely.
And so that is Dream Scenario, which is also in cinemas from tomorrow. Just time for the final film now. It's this.
Yo aquí para recordar quién fue Augusto Pong.
Yo soy Augusto. ¿Y tú qué eres?
Yo soy la Paula. Nos conocemos hace más de 20 años.
That was The Eternal Memory. And this is, again, as I was saying, another festival film. I actually saw this at Sundance in January of this year, but my memory of it is somewhat faded now. So Jordan,
ironically,
could you please remind me and the listeners what this documentary is about?
Yeah, so this is Maite Alberdi's documentary. You may know her as the director of The Mole Agent from a few years ago. This one's about an elderly couple, Augusto Gongora and Paulina Urrutia, who they're deeply in love, have been in a deeply affectionate relationship for two decades or more. But Augusto suffers from dementia, from Alzheimer's, and Pauli is his primary carer, as well as his love in life. The film is shot in a sort of fly-on-the-wall type fashion. You get flashbacks to home movies and documented recordings of the pair from the past. But for the most part, what you're getting is an extremely intimate, unvarnished account of their day-to-day lives, which appear to just be recorded by Pauli as she sort of sets up a camera in their home. I'm not even sure that they had like a camera person in their home, because it really is super intimate, like literally those two and a camera in their bedroom at points. It gets that close to them. And it starts off extremely gentle, very sweet. Augusto wakes up, he has no memory of Pauli because of his condition, but the way she sort of catches him up on her life is just beyond lovely. It's sort of the sweetest, most caring thing. And he has this huge grin on his face the entire time. He sort of can't believe that this is his life, that he's married to this woman. It's really, really just
heartwarming stuff. Most of the time, I mean, for the first half of the film at least, all the time he's spending with Polly, they're having the most delightful time, essentially. They go on long walks, they go dancing, they sort of have their daily routine to keep Augusto active and safe, but also to give Polly something of a life outside her role as Augusto's carer. So she is part of this kind of acting troupe and she performs in plays locally. And Augusto is sort of seen sort of taking part. Like there's this lovely moment where they're sort of practicing the choreography on stage and, you know, everyone knows this choreography, but obviously Augusto doesn't. So he's sort of dancing around, but completely out of step with everyone else. But he's just having a great time because he gets to be part of what everyone else is doing. But of course, Alzheimer's is an awful, debilitating illness. And we get to see a handful of Augusto's episodes. At one point he wakes up in the middle of night with no memory of where he is, who Paoli is, anything that's happened in his life for the last 20 years. He's banging on the windows in tears, sort of demanding to see his friends who he claims have left. Awful, just horrible stuff to like bear witness to. We hear about an incident where Augusto started walking around the house after he's sort of supposed to have been asleep in his room when Polly was due on stage in a matter of minutes. And it's sort of a very stressful moment for the pair of them. Really sort of heartbreaking stuff to see this play out, particularly when you see just how wonderful their relationship is when Augusto isn't having these episodes, to then see what their sort of relationship is reduced to when Polly just has to try her best to comfort Augusto, while she herself is really suffering from the fact that she has to see the person that she loves most in the world going through this. It's really, really tough stuff. We learn that Augusto was a culture reporter, a broadcaster. At one point, he even interviewed Javier Bardem on screen. So we get like glimpses of what their lives were before Alzheimer's, before dementia, but really little more than that. We never see their children, for example. It's very focused on what their lives are at this moment in time and how they're coping with Augusto's condition and more importantly, how their love has persisted amid something so unspeakably horrible. So I really like this. It falls into that category where it's a film that's almost too sad for me to ever consider watching again, because I don't think I could ever watch some of that stuff a second time, but I thought it was ultimately really beautiful and one of the sort of more profound depictions of, you know, real genuine love I've seen on screen in a long time.
Yeah, to be honest, you have refreshed my memory quite well, because I just saw it when I was watched so many films at Sundance, and
they can blur together, can't they, when you do that.
But I remember just finding it very touching, just a bit too sad, because it's just such a sort of brutal disease, really, that, I mean, you've got to be in the right frame of mind to be able to watch this, really. But sort of, you know, there is some real sort of tenderness and just some lovely moments if, you know, you are up to it.
It's very brief as well. Like, it's only about 80 minutes long. Like, it's not trying to beat you down or anything. It's really just wants to show you what life is like for these people. And it just wants to show you, like, even though, you know, living with this is extremely challenging for both of them, like they still manage to have like a beautiful existence despite the fact that this is going on. Like the moments that they have together where Augusto remembers and where their relationship is kind of what it used to be, like it feels like that's sort of what they're living for, and all that is worth it despite the kind of pain that they go through at other times of the day. So yeah, it's obviously a super important film. Like, you know, so many people suffer from Alzheimer's, and this is what it's like for a lot of people. In a way, they're in a much better position than a lot of people will be. You know, they appear to own their home. They don't appear to be in any kind of financial difficulty. Like, neither of them seem to need to work. They're both retired, seemingly. They don't have any kind of outside forces bearing down on them. It's simply about these two trying to exist and survive and make the most of what they've got. But I found it kind of overwhelming in a way, and very much worth seeking out. Obviously very different from Dream Scenario and Anatomy of a Fall. Like this is as true to life as you can get. But even in a very good week, I would say this is sort of worth seeking out if you can.
In a strong week, if you fancy seeing that as well, that is The Eternal Memory, which is also in cinemas tomorrow. And we're almost out of time now, so just a few things to get through. Film of the week, Jordan, what's your pick for this week?
Oh, tough one. They're pretty much all neck and neck for me, to be honest. But if I had to pick one, I would probably go Dream Scenario, just because that Nick Cage sex scene, you've got to see it to believe the facial reaction he comes out with.
Yeah, I'm in the same boat. If I could sort of cop out and do a joint winner, it would be Dream Scenario and Anatomy of a Fall. But if I had to pick one, it's Dream Scenario for me. Just really, really did enjoy that. Just a reminder that if you like this podcast, you can make your life easier by subscribing. Just press the button now and you'll be all set every week. These films aren't the only exciting thing out this week, Jordan, are they? We also have the new issue of Total Film, which is on shelves now as you listen to this. And it's fronted by The Bike Riders, sort of epic cover feature by Jane Crowther there, looking at Jeff Nichols' super cool 60s biker movie. There's also loads more in there, like you going very in-depth with Zack Snyder on Rebel Moon and his wider career.
Sure did. Yep. I got to speak to him all about his new space opera epic and about the sort of signatures that he's exhibited across his career. So I got to go through, you know, tons of stuff with him, and he was great value. He got to tell me some really interesting stuff.
And plus there's Sofia Coppola's Priscilla, and then there's new bits on Leave the World Behind, All of Us Strangers, Argyle, Chicken Run, Dawn of the Nugget, and Doctor Who, and just loads more. So please do check that out. Bike Riders cover of Total Film, which is out now. And then just a final thing before we go, we always have a listener's question. So we've had this one in. I hate this weather, just want to sleep and hibernate. What films should I watch that have great bed scenes, not like that?
I was going to pick Dream Scenario again, but unfortunately now I can't. Yeah, great question. I feel like hibernating as well. It's an awful day today, weather terrible. Looking into this, a lot of films very bed centric. Bed Knobs and Broomsticks, obviously, they fly around in a bed. The Exorcist, Misery, Goldfinger, Gerald's Game, like a lot of films where people are just like stuck to beds for a long time. But I'm going to go for A Nightmare on Elm Street, where, as you'll remember, Johnny Depp is swallowed by his mattress and, you know, ground up in there. I've never really known what happens in
sort
there.
Sort of spewed back out onto the ceiling.
Yeah, followed by, a truly astonishing amount of blood that erupts onto the ceiling in kind of gravity-defying fashion. I just remember that sequence just searing itself onto my memory when I saw it for the first time, obviously far too young, and just being like a little bit afraid to go back to bed again. It's got to be like the most iconic kill in any Nightmare on Elm Street movie.
Oh yeah, 100%. And then I don't really know what to go for this, because my first instinct as soon as I heard bed was Exorcist, but then I sort of think if you're trying to get cozy in this weather, I don't know if that's the best film to recommend.
Nightmare on Elm Street is probably not the best choice either, really.
So maybe I'll go for something cozier like Bed Knobs and Broomsticks. I was always fond of that when I was younger. And
flying around
on it. And then I love that football match they have with the animated animals. So if you're getting sort of cozy, avoiding the weather, thick duvet on, get Bed Knobs and Broomsticks on. I haven't actually seen it since I was a kid, so please don't judge me if it actually is aged very poorly, but yes, that's what I'm going for. But that's basically all we've got time for this week now, so literally just time for us to say goodbye. Bye, Jordan.
Bye.
Bye.
What is that? Oh, no, not the beast! Not the beast! Ah! Out of my eyes! My eyes! Ah! Ah!
They can't come true. Step closer, you know that I want you. I can tell by the head.